This is The Meaning of Green, Season 4. I'm Vivian Thompson. In Season 1 of The Meaning of Green, my guests and I examined how we have managed to solve or not to solve major environmental problems, and we applied the policy lessons we had learned to climate change. Season 2 investigated the links between power, freedom, and the environment, and whether those links shed light on the coronavirus's emergence and spread. Season 3 looked at place and the environment. We traveled to different locations in the U.S. and around the world, characterized their environmental issues and possible remedies, and explored connections with other places. Season 4 is about environmental and public health protection during challenging economic times. The Meaning of Green is independently produced in Cedar Closet Studios in Silver Spring, Maryland, and has no sponsor. No outside entity influences the content of this podcast. Before I started The Meaning of Green, I was for 20 years a professor of environmental policy at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. Outside of academia, I have also been an environmental regulatory official in Virginia and at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. My three published books are about garbage transport, climate change policy in the U.S., Brazil, and Germany, and about who wields power and how when we regulate air pollution. You can find out more about The Meaning of Green and find links for all podcast episodes at the podcast's website, meaningofgreen.com. This episode and the next one, Shotgun Marriage Cats and Shotgun Marriage Kittens, are about the direct ways in which states might or might not be important for environmental policy. By direct ways, I mean through their environmental programs or legal actions. Shotgun marriage refers to the forced, sometimes uneasy relationships between the state, federal, and local governments when it comes to solving environmental and public health problems. This episode is devoted to state-level actions on water, climate change, and renewable energy. In the next part of Shotgun Marriage, garbage and smog will be front and center. In a sprawling country of 50 individual states enjoying considerable independent powers, you might expect to find some political tension over pollution and resources, not only between the states and the national government, but also between the states themselves. There's a lot of high drama in the ways in which those relationships have played out. Let's start with water. When I lived in coastal California in the late 70s and early 80s, the rains came, predictably, and not in catastrophic quantities. Californians experienced an annual dry season and periodic drought, and they coped. My aunt, who lived in Berkeley, was fastidious about avoiding unnecessary water use. She would pour gray water left over from washing dishes onto her garden. But my time in California was perhaps an anomaly. The American West has been in drought status for 22 years. Water rights are at the center of many struggles in the U.S.'s arid western states. Perhaps the best book ever written about water in the American West is Cadillac Desert by the late Mark Reisner. In vivid terms, Reisner captures the deceit, hubris, and desperation that are evident at every turn in the West's long-term water wars. Cadillac Desert was turned into a four-part PBS special in 1998 that you can find on YouTube. The book and the film devote special attention to the Colorado River, an important source of water and hydroelectric power for an estimated 40 million Westerners. In the film, Reisner and Floyd Dominey speak to the Colorado River's famous wildness, which Reisner likens in his book to a rampant horse in a balsa corral. From 1959 to 1969, Dominey headed the Federal Bureau of Reclamation. That's the federal agency that built and now manages dams, canals, and artificial water projects all over the American West. The background noise in these clips is the roar of the Colorado River.
The river was tempestuous, willful, headstrong. It would flow at the flow of the Mississippi at low water in a little canyon, really. I mean, the Grand Canyon is huge, but the actual river bed is small. And this river would rise 70 feet.
It ran wild for 2 or 3 months every year, and it would get down to a trickle in August and September. The fluctuations on the Colorado River is amazing. It's just not a very predictable river.
It was an outlaw river, and we couldn't let it not be regulated. And that's why I think it wasn't just that it was the only significant river in the Southwest, but that it was so willful. This nature that we say we love wild, we really like it quite well regulated. And we went after the Colorado River with a kind of a special vengeance.
I had no sympathy for those who felt that nature couldn't be improved upon. Now, I admit that nature can improve upon man. We're probably the supreme being. But in the realm of rivers, I think man can improve upon them. I have no apologies. I was a crusader for the development of water. I was the Messiah. I was the evangelist that went out and argued persuasively to develop our rivers and water supplies for the benefit of people. I don't apologize for that.
100 years ago, in 1922, 7 Western states and the federal government negotiated a compact to divide up the Colorado River's flow. Unfortunately, unrealistically rosy assumptions were made about how much water the river could provide. Since that time, lawsuits have flown over how to share the river's water. Native American tribes who weren't at the table in 1922 have won rights to about 1/5 of the Colorado River's water. Plants and animals dependent on the river have never had a seat at the table, but the Endangered Species Act has driven the establishment of some fish conservation programs. Now it's hard to chart how the river's water will be shared. The 21st century drought in the American West is thought to be the driest 22-year period since at least the year 800. The drought has greatly diminished the Colorado River's flow and has brought the river's huge reservoirs to their lowest levels ever. 2 of the U.S.'s highest concrete dams, Hoover Dam and Glen Canyon Dam, are on the Colorado River, and their reservoirs are massive. But because of the drought, hikers can now explore the beautiful, recently exposed canyons that were once flooded by Lake Powell, the reservoir for the controversial Glen Canyon Dam. Glen Canyon Dam was finished in 1963, near the tail end of the federal government's expensive dam and reservoir building bender. For much of the 20th century, the U.S. Congress practically gave a blank check for big water projects to the Federal Bureau of Reclamation and the Army Corps of Engineers. It didn't matter if the projects weren't needed, or worse, if their costs outweighed their benefits. That frenzy began to die down in the 1970s as we opened our eyes to the extensive negative ecological impacts of dams, especially large ones. Now we're bringing some dams down, but the population of the dry American West has continued to grow, and all those people and the agriculture in the American West need water. The rest of the U.S. depends on fruits and vegetables grown in California, so we Easterners are part of the West's water crises. In an October 2022 Vail symposium, Pat Mulroy, who is the longtime head of the Water Authority in the Las Vegas area, spoke to the challenges facing the states depending on the Colorado River. The Federal Bureau of Reclamation has demanded that the Colorado River states reduce their demand on the system or face federally imposed restrictions.
I mean, as long as hydrology fed those reservoirs, that faulty equation was going to come out okay. I mean, let me put it in perspective. The upper basin, the 4 upper basin states, have 50% of the obligation to the Mexican Treaty, to meet the Mexican Treaty. That's why you built Lake Powell. That's why you demanded to have Lake Powell. Without that savings account, your water supply in 4 states is going to be pretty ugly. So if you want to hike the canyons in Lake Powell, knock yourself out. But in the meantime, water is going to have to get cut off everywhere in order to send it to Mexico. That's the treaty that the United States entered into. Yes, we have since 2002 watched the system start to diminish. And to be very frank with you, sitting at that moment in time, it was very hard, particularly for some states, to wrap their heads around how bad it could get. And if they could envision how bad it was going to get, they envisioned that to be out there in 2050, 2060, long after they were way gone and, you know, buried somewhere. The rate of change is what's problematic. It's not that nobody expected the change. It's the rate of change. And so where the 2007 guidelines, the shortage guidelines, and the 2012 Mexican Treaty made people feel, particularly in some states, some of us were always far more skeptical than others, made people feel much more secure about having a pathway to buffet against that, it is moving much faster than they envisioned. And so I would say that you've got seven states that are looking down the barrel of a gun, and they have a treaty obligation to the country of Mexico that they won't take kindly to if it's not met. There are a lot of really ugly consequences on the table. And what's difficult for me is when I participate in conferences and I listen to some of the rhetoric, everyone's very good in spewing their own positions. But the answer isn't going to be in spewing your own position. It's going to be in finding a common path forward. And finding a villain, finding your favorite villain, whether it's the farmer, whether it's the city, it matters not who you pick, is not going to get us there. So I think we recognize that we would reach this day sooner or later. It's just that it came far sooner than anyone ever expected.
In other contexts, Ms. Mulroy has pleaded with us all to imagine ourselves as citizens not only of a country and a state, but also a watershed. In the eastern United States, water wars are less focused on water quantity, since our rains tend to be more reliable and generous, but on who is polluting shared waters the most. So, for example, urban and agricultural runoff from several states has long poisoned the Chesapeake Bay. The bay is the largest estuary in the United States and the third largest estuary in the world. The Chesapeake Bay states fight over who needs to clean up their act the most. In one recent lawsuit, Maryland, Virginia, Delaware, and the District of Columbia, in partnership with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, an NGO, have sued EPA. They want EPA to exact stronger Chesapeake Bay cleanup plans from Pennsylvania and New York. As some listeners already know, last year I moved from one of those Chesapeake Bay states, Virginia, to another Bay state, Maryland. You might think, well, those two neighbor states might be kind of similar in their politics and traditions. In fact, the two states are pretty different. The 2022 elections spotlight one of those differences. Republicans won 5 of Virginia's 11 seats in the U.S. House of Representatives, whereas in Maryland, only one of the state's 8 seats in the House went to a Republican. But there are other important differences that bear on environmental issues. In Virginia, local governments need permission from the state legislature to adopt measures like plastic bag taxes or restrictions on the use of leaf blowers. In Maryland, local governments can enact their own plastic bag restrictions, and many have done so. In my new county, Montgomery County, officials are considering a ban on the sale and use of gasoline-powered leaf blowers. Although coal now fuels practically no electricity generation in Virginia, coal is part of the state's political and cultural DNA because of Southwest Virginia's longtime coal production. I wrote about coal-based controversies in Virginia in my 2017 book, Climate of Capitulation. Maryland is not a leading coal mining state. Now only a relatively small amount of Maryland's electricity comes from coal-fired power plants. Maryland adopted a greenhouse gas reduction law back in 2009. Virginia's first major greenhouse gas reduction law came only in 2020. An important commonality is that both Maryland and Virginia were slave states. Lingering disadvantages from the legacy of racism magnify the vulnerability of African American communities to environmental problems of all kinds. We'll circle back to that topic in the next Shotgun Marriage episode. Well, I could go on with these state comparisons, but you get the idea. Because each of the 50 states is so distinctive, getting members of Congress to agree on environmental issues is hard, sort of like herding cats. Sometimes, specific kinds of difficult economic circumstances force the hand of national lawmakers. Many of our national energy laws, dating back to 1975, have come after the price of oil jumped. Those energy laws have generally stressed conservation and the development of renewable energy, but they've also supported fossil fuel use and production. That's even the case for the U.S.'s new climate law, the Inflation Reduction Act. To take one example, President Jimmy Carter and the Congress responded to the 1970s oil supply crisis by supporting conservation and the use of coal. Here's President Carter in February 1977. The president, wearing a sweater, is seated by a fireplace with a cozy fire in it.
Our program will emphasize conservation. The amount of energy being wasted, which could be saved, is greater than the total energy that we are importing from foreign countries. We will also stress development of our rich coal reserves in an environmentally sound way. We'll emphasize research on solar energy and other renewable energy sources, and we'll maintain strict safeguards on necessary atomic energy production. We must face the fact that the energy shortage is permanent. There is no way we can solve it quickly, but if we all cooperate and make modest sacrifices, if we learn to live thriftily and remember the importance of helping our neighbors, then we can find ways to adjust and to make our society more efficient and our own lives more enjoyable and productive.
Until 2022, the U.S. had no comprehensive national climate change or renewable energy law. So the states have tried to fill that gap. 24 states are members of the Climate Alliance, and those states have undertaken a long list of actions to address climate change. California's longstanding set of regulations and programs is the most aggressive. California is the only state with authority to set emission standards for cars and what are called off-road engines, like leaf blowers. Once California has adopted such standards, other states can adopt them too. In 2004, California used that authority to reduce greenhouse gas pollution from new vehicles. Those standards have been strengthened, and by 2035, all new cars sold in California must achieve zero emissions at the tailpipe. California has engaged in years-long battles with auto companies, with the Bush and Trump administrations, and with other states over California's ability to set its own vehicle emission standards. Now, EPA and several auto companies, including Ford, VW, and Volvo, are siding with California. California also caps overall greenhouse gas pollution from major polluters like electric power companies. That cap decreases over time. California's list of climate change measures is long, and I can't do them justice here. 12 eastern states have also adopted a greenhouse gas pollution cap, which applies only to power plants. This program is called the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, and it started in 2009. So, how well have these programs worked in reducing the U.S.'s greenhouse gas emissions? One set of policies has worked well. Those are the programs in 30 U.S. states to force the electric utilities to move away from fossil fuels and toward renewables. These state-level programs have definitely helped spur the growth of renewable energy. Federal tax incentives for renewable energy have been important too, and those incentives just received a huge boost with the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022. Wind power has expanded greatly, even in states like Oklahoma that have no renewable energy requirements. That's because of those federal tax incentives, decreasing costs, payments utilities provide to landowners, improved technology, and lots of wind. Many states sponsor programs to advance energy efficiency. California and Vermont are two states that have been at the forefront of these efforts. California's longstanding energy efficiency programs have restrained growth in per capita electricity consumption. Efficiency Vermont, a utility created in 1999, estimates that electricity use in Vermont would have been 16% higher in 2020 without the energy efficiency measures sponsored by the utility. Efficiency Vermont tries to charm people into embracing energy efficiency in their homes and businesses, as we hear in this YouTube clip.
When your home isn't efficient, you aren't efficient. So when your refrigerator isn't operating right, you get ice buildup, and you feel the need to conquer that ice. Inevitably, you bring power tools into the equation, and you feel like an ice sculptor. Then you are compelled to make an ice sculpture of your childhood dog. It doesn't have to be this way. I don't have to make an ice sculpture of my childhood dog. Look for the Energy Star logo when shopping for appliances to keep both you and your home running efficiently.
The last set of actions that have undoubtedly had an important effect on the nation's greenhouse gas profile are California's clean car standards. Those standards have been adopted in 17 other states and are stricter than federal standards. Things can get a little murky when we try to evaluate the effectiveness of many state-level greenhouse gas programs. Designing programs with pollution caps like those in California and in the northeastern states is tricky. For example, experts have called into question the long-term effectiveness of California's program to limit greenhouse gas pollution from major polluters. A concern that applies to the pollution caps in California and in the Northeast is that pollution might increase outside the program area if it's cheaper, say, to import electricity from places not covered by the cap. And analytically, it's always difficult to disentangle the effect of various government and market forces on the U.S.'s greenhouse gas pollution, which peaked in 2007 and then started a steady decline. Here are some of the factors that have contributed to that decline. Federal regulations have pushed some coal-fired power plants into long overdue retirement. Natural gas has replaced coal as a fuel for electricity generation because fracking has increased the supply and lowered the price of natural gas. We've had two 21st century recessions and a global pandemic, which depressed pollution of all kinds. Cars have become cleaner and more fuel efficient because of federal standards, and manufacturers of renewable technologies have improved their products. Another complication in evaluating how well state-level climate change programs have worked is that when calculating their greenhouse gas pollution, states tend to include pollution that happens within their borders. Well, that sounds reasonable, right? But they tend to ignore what's called embodied pollution in the products they import from other states. I'm not just making this up. A recent study indicates that many states with climate change programs might be underestimating their greenhouse gas pollution if they ignore embodied pollution in their product imports. And one has to wonder, do trash exporting states like New York and Maryland routinely count greenhouse gas pollution that's created by their trash in landfills located in trash importing states like Pennsylvania and Virginia? As a final note, I'll mention two state-initiated lawsuits against the Federal Environmental Protection Agency that concern climate change. First, Massachusetts v. EPA involved the claim by Massachusetts and many other states that the EPA's failure to control greenhouse gases was contributing to harm within their borders. Here is Professor Jody Freeman of the Harvard University Law School with a summary of Massachusetts v. EPA, which was decided in 2007. Professor Freeman spoke in 2021 for a podcast called Environmental Insights.
This case it wound its way to the Supreme Court over a period of years during the George W. Bush administration. And the heart and soul of it was an effort to require the EPA to set rules to control carbon emissions that were coming from the transportation sector. So the environmental litigants, the advocacy groups, and it ended up being a combination of states together with them, including Massachusetts, which is why it's called Massachusetts v. EPA, were arguing that the EPA under the Clean Air Act had an obligation to regulate these emissions coming from cars and trucks. And originally, the George W. Bush administration's point of view was, no, we don't. That greenhouse gases aren't pollutants under the Clean Air Act, so we can't regulate them. And their view was, even if you tell us, even if you, the Supreme Court, say that actually they are pollutants, we have many policy reasons why we think using the Clean Air Act to control greenhouse gases is a very bad idea. So the EPA at the time didn't want to use the Clean Air Act to attack greenhouse gas emissions. And that was the issue that went up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court decided, first of all, the most crucial issue, the issue of standing. Does anybody really have legal standing to sue over the harms caused by climate change? Because it's such a disparate, distributed harm. Nobody's especially affected. And the court, by a vote of 5-4, a very close vote, a very different Supreme Court, by the way, voted that, yes, Massachusetts as a state has standing. Losing its coastline over time is a sufficient harm. And they also ruled that greenhouse gases are a pollutant as it's defined under the Clean Air Act, so the EPA has authority to regulate greenhouse gases. And the reasons the agency gave for not doing so were not consistent with the law. So they sent it back to the George W. Bush administration to say, you either have to set these standards or give us a better reason why the science won't let you. You know, and the scientific record was so strong in favor of the harms caused by greenhouse gases that they really didn't have an argument left. But they didn't do anything before leaving office. So in the waning days of the George W. Bush administration, they chose still not to regulate these emissions from cars and trucks. And that is what sort of was the foundation for the Obama administration. When Barack Obama won the presidency, he came in promising to take the first step in setting these standards, which requires making a finding that greenhouse gases pose a danger to human health and welfare. That's sort of the scientific determination that an agency, that EPA has to make before it sets standards. And that's what you're talking about when you say endangerment finding.
Since 2010, EPA has used the Clean Air Act to regulate greenhouse gases from vehicles and from industrial sources. And then came the surprising 2022 Supreme Court decision in the case West Virginia v. EPA. West Virginia challenged EPA's Clean Air Act requirements for reductions in greenhouse gas emissions from coal-fired power plants. West Virginia, joined by 18 other states, claimed the EPA's requirements went beyond what the law allowed. West Virginia won, and EPA lost. The Supreme Court issued an opinion that veered into unexpected and somewhat incomprehensible territory. Here is Professor Lisa Heinzerling of Georgetown Law providing one of the clearest explanations I've heard of this decision. Professor Heinzerling spoke with Joel Cohen of Talks on Law.
So the idea is that the court basically is looking, is this a big question? Is it a question of economic and political significance? And if it is, it's just going to look at the statute and say, is it clear? It doesn't do the same kind of statutory analysis it would do in other cases, analysis of the language and history and structure of the statute in question. This doesn't do that. This gives really gets the court off the hook. They look, they sort of eyeball it and say it's a major question, and then at that point they're looking for extreme clarity.
What does that mean? Is it clear? That, I mean, that seems in and of itself, the test seems pretty broad.
I can't help but say it's not clear, right? I mean, it's just not clear how much clarity is required.
Why don't we look at how major questions can be applied to the West Virginia case?
Yes. So what the court did is figure out first, was this a major question? This question of deciding to enact emission reductions at power plants by looking in part at the potential of shifting electricity from coal to other kinds of power plant sources. And so the court said, yeah, that was a major question. It was a major question. I think the court has at least six, maybe more factors that it cites. A quite complicated multifactorial test for deciding whether something was a major question. And then once he found that this was indeed a major question, so at that point, the court is looking for extreme clarity.
And was the language that was found to be too, I don't know, opaque or too broad, was that the best practices approach?
Yeah, the language was the best system of emission reduction. And here, Chief Justice Roberts said, well, that doesn't mean anything. Shorn of context, he says, system doesn't mean anything. And so he doesn't find that word clear enough, partly, I think, by just completely abstracting that word from its statutory context.
Under major questions, it doesn't matter whether or not the EPA's approach was brilliant or whether it was effective or needed. All that is irrelevant if it is unclear and a major question.
Correct. Correct.
EPA intends to move forward with modified restrictions for coal-fired power plants. To sum up, the states matter and don't matter with respect to water rights, climate change action, and renewable energy. It was the federal government that developed countless big water projects all over the American West. But the states, subject to the Colorado River Compact, are locked into a continuing series of negotiations over how to share the river's scarce water. States that have forced or incentivized the use of renewable energy by their utilities have helped move us away from electricity generated from fossil fuels. California's stringent vehicle standards have been adopted in other states and have set the stage for federal standards. But because of confounding factors, it's really hard to tease out the specific impact of many state-level climate change programs. One can say, though, that state-level climate change action against the federal government in court has made important marks, as we see with the two Supreme Court cases highlighted in this episode. Don't miss the second part of Shotgun Marriage, which will feature a battle over smog that threatened to shut down driving in the city of Los Angeles.
We held a press conference announcing that 80% of the cars are going to have to get off the road. There were about 30 cameras at this press conference. First question I got from some guy up close to the camera said, "Is this a joke?"
I'm Vivian Thompson. Thank you for listening to The Meaning of Green, Season 4.